Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. We have a very interesting show for you this evening. Our guest tonight is Hirsch Eidlis. He's a direct descendant of the Marsha. He has a tremendous library of Jewish ancient prints, Kisvei Yad, and letters that basically cover just about every part of Jewish history from its earliest moments to the 20th century. Good evening, Mr. Eidlis.
Good evening.
Tell us how you came about this collection of books. At what moment did you decide that you want to work with books, that you want to work with Kisvei Yad, with Sforim, and so?
Well, when I was 7 years old, when I left Hungary, I already had a collection of Jewish luchot, which were taken away from me by the Hungarian border patrol. They thought it was contraband. So I had about 40 calendars from before 1942 that I collected as a kid. And since then, I was always very interested in early printed books.
You said that at age 7, you already had a collection of 40 calendars. What specifically attracted a little kid to old calendars?
Well, I thought I could put together a collection because of different years, and I put them together. I found it interesting.
And from there, how did you graduate to books and manuscripts?
Well, as time went on, when I learned in Yeshiva and Chassan Sofer on the Lower East Side, I used to frequent the Hebrew bookstores on the Lower East Side. And one of my earliest purchases was by Feldheim, in Feldheim's bookstore. I bought, I believe it was an 18th century cipher.
Tell us about some of the unusual items that you had, some of the unusual items that you bought and sold.
Well, I had many, many items that I already sold. But some of the most fascinating things that I have now is I have several incunabula, meaning books printed in the 15th century, before 1500. And the most fascinating one is Arba Turim, Tur Orachaim, that was printed in Spain in 1485. As we know, the Gerush, the expulsion of Jews from Spain, was in 1492. And when people ran, the things that they carried with them were usually small, valuable, and light items. And the fact that these things survived the Inquisition, such a big book as a Tur Orachaim, in such a fascinating condition, only missing the first leaf, but the text itself is there complete, with a colophon, which is the last page, which has the first Hebrew printer's mark, which is a lion and a red shield, which is known as the first Hebrew printer's mark. I'm fascinated by this book. I've had it for a while, and I still have it, and every time I look at it, I'm just touching a piece of history that for over 500 years survived the Inquisition, the Nazis, the pogroms, Stalin, and also Nei Israel.
Okay. I see you also have a lot of catalogs. I understand that at one point you work on the catalogs of the Judaica sections at Sotheby's. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your experiences there?
Well, in 1984, I was one of the catalogers for Sotheby's for the Alexander Gutman collection. Basically, what he did was he took out books after Kristallnacht from the Hochschule für das Wissenschaft des Judentum, a large number of manuscripts and incunabula, and he kept it for himself for over 40 years, never telling anyone that he was the one that had these documents and books. It was in 1984, we thought that statute of limitations already expired, that it brought it to Sotheby's. And when I cataloged it together with some other people, and some people such as Mr. Jesselson got wind of it, that this is now being offered for sale, they went to the DA, and the DA was working to stop the sale. Ultimately, they made a deal with the seller. He got, I believe, $1 million, and the rest of the money went to charitable organizations.
What are some of the items that were in that collection?
One was a Tanakh on vellum with Rashi, which was written in Prague in, I don't remember the exact date, but in the 1480s. And then there was another fascinating piece, a Machzor, I believe it was Nusach Catalonia Keminhag Barcelona, with my first, I believe it was the first example of micrography. This was, again, on vellum. And also there was a Rashi on vellum, one of the earliest copies of Rashi, I believe it was from the year 1296.
Wow. What is, to the best of your knowledge, the oldest manuscript of any Masechta in existence? How old would that be?
Well, we know there's one complete manuscript of Shas, which is the Ksav Yad Menachem, but that's complete Shas, and there's only one such copy of individual Masechtas. there are several, not too many. There are very few 13th, 14th century and 15th century manuscripts of Talmudic tractates, for a simple reason that the Inquisition was very eager to destroy them, and they were very successful in destroying most of the copies. So off the top of my head, I don't think there's much before, say, the 13th century. And there are very few from the 13th, 14th, and 15th century. And there's only one complete manuscript of Shas, and that would be the Munich Codex, Saviad Menchen.
If the Mission Codex would go on sale, for the sake of argument, how much would something like that command today?
It would be in the millions. It's hard to guess, and I don't have a clue, but it would be for a lot of money.
Where is that today? Who has it?
In Munich.
In Germany.
Yes.
And it's owned by the city?
Yes.
Who did it belong to before the war? Do we know, or...?
Well, it belonged to them.
Oh, it belonged to the city.
Yes.
They had it in their hand for centuries.
Yes.
Since the time of the Inquisition or whatever other pogrom there may have been.
I don't know since they have it, but they... I don't know since when they have it, but they have it for a long time.
Are there any Kisveyad or Oldsforim in Europe that belonged to Yidden before the war and now belong to the governments of various Eastern European countries or other such places?
The big cities, such as the BN in Paris, Oxford, the British Library, and many other major cities in Europe had nice Judaica collection. Copenhagen has a Simonsena collection. Amsterdam has the Rosenthaliana collection. So, in a way, you could credit these libraries with the survival of these Hebrew books.
Well, you mentioned the British Library. I mean, Britain is famous for some of its libraries, like the Bodleian Library, where we're constantly finding new Kisveyad that have long been forgotten otherwise.
Yes. What's interesting about that is that the collection of Reb David Oppenheim, which they tried to sell it for many years, I believe it was going from place to place for a period of 90 years, and they couldn't find the buyer until at the end it was, I believe, the Bodleian that bought the entire collection for a couple of thousand pounds, which is very little money even relative to those days when a pound was a lot of money. But it had some over 90 incunabula and over 1,000 manuscripts. And it was probably the most magnificent collection available, but it ended up in the Bodleian. So that's where it's now. That's where all these manuscripts that they find, they come from the collection, not only from Reb David Oppenheim, but that's a major source for that collection.
I recently saw, for example, a couple of Perushim on Maseches Yuma by Reb Yitzchok Alovon, who was one of the Talmidim of Rashi, and also by Rabbeinu Eliyakim, who was a contemporary of Rashi. And they both came from Kisveyad at the Bodleian. Who knows how many other such things they have?
Most of it is cataloged. I don't know if all, but most of it is cataloged. So if somebody is interested in finding out what's available, could simply browse the catalogs. Also, in Israel, there's Hamachon LeTatzlumei Kitveyad. Not only do they have a list of the catalogs, but they have actually a photograph of all the catalogs.
All the manuscripts.
Yes. And if anybody wants to know more about it, contact Dr. Benjamin Richler, He's probably the greatest expert in this field, and he'll tell you what's available and what's not.
I am sure that over the years, you must have come across some very, very interesting stories, whether they happened to you directly or stories related to some of the Sforim or Kisvei Yad that you've handled. I'm sure you also may have had some funny happenings as you were selling some of this stuff or as you were collecting them. Care to tell us some of those stories?
Well, one funny story was that I was flying many years ago on El Al in business class, and I was the only person other than another person. It was only the two of us in business class, and after a while I was bored, so I started walking back and forth. So after like the second or third attempt to re-enter the business class, the gentleman who was sitting there asked me, "Who am I? Do I belong in the business class? Why am I going in and out?" So I asked him, "Who are you?" So he told me that he was a pilot and he's flying back to Israel. So I told him, "Yeah, I belong in business class," and we started talking. He asked what I was doing, and I told him that I deal with Hebrew books and manuscripts. It turned out that he had a huge collection of manuscripts, which I ended up buying from him. So it was like something that started out as not a friendly thing, but we ended up being very good friends, and I bought from him his entire collection of over 100 manuscripts.
What were some of the manuscripts that were in that collection?
There were many letters from famous people, particularly political letters from various Israeli leaders and pre-state major figures, letters between Ben-Gurion and Rav Maimon protesting, writing letters protesting Ben-Gurion's philosophies regarding religious Jews in 1948, a couple of months after the establishment of the state. I think I still have that letter. Then political letters from throughout the Sinai campaign on how to behave or not to behave during the war. Some of them very fascinating.
What are some of the most fascinating books or manuscripts that you've handled through your career?
Oh, there are many, many. Once somebody offered me the first 10 pages of a Hebrew incunable, Sefer HaYikrim, I bought the first 10 leaves, and like 2 years or so later, I was able to find the entire Ikrim minus the first leaf at an auction in Israel. So, of course, I bought that one, and I completed it with the first leaf that I had. So I still have the 9 leaves, you know, pages, leaves 2 through 10, which are duplicates. So that it's very rare that you succeed in completing an incunable, but it happened to me once.
Besides that, any other interesting stuff? And when I say interesting, obviously anything historic by itself is automatically by definition interesting. But I mean something very, very unusual, something that one would not expect under normal circumstances.
I found some very interesting documents on vellum in bindings of early printed books. In the 16th and 17th and even in the 18th century, paper was expensive. So bookbinders, when they needed paper, rather than purchase the paper, they would take old papers, glue it together, and that's how they made the binding. So several situations, I bought books and I noticed that the bindings were slightly not straight. So I opened the bindings. It turned out what was in the binding netted me 10 times as much as what the book did.
Like, for example?
I had, for example, the situation of Agunot, and the Heter Agunot from a major 18th century Rav, three documents in one binding that he gave a Heter Aguna. I no longer recall the name because I sold it quite a while ago. Things like that. Or also I found fragments of Tanakhs, 14th century Tanakhs in binding, fragments of vellum.
Wow. Apparently those printers did not appreciate what they had, or at the time it wasn't worth as much.
Right, the bookbinders know. It saved them... It saved the bookbinder money by not having to buy, you know, the binding. He glued it together, and that's what he made. Yeah.
Was it actually good, lasting binding under normal circumstances, or it didn't last as much as the real thing?
No. It was a very good binding. I just noticed what it was made of, so it took me a while to separate it. It was not an easy job.
I am sure.
But I managed to separate it, and so. Sell them as individual sheets.
Looking around the room with a very, very long wall of Sforim, a lot of them are catalogs, a lot of them, as I look through, you have some very, very ancient stuff. What are some of the stuff that you have here? And what do you specifically collect as opposed to what you buy for resale?
I collect particular Nidchei Yisrael. For example, books about Indian Jews. I have a huge collection of Sifrei HaKaraim. Now, whether they Yisrael or not, it's Machloket HaPoskim. The Rambam, for example, is matur to circumcise a Karaite child on Shabbat. So clearly he must think that the Jews. Also, he says, as long as they do not insult the Rabbinites, they should be treated with respect. Today in Israel, the Rabbanut treats them differently, but if you look in many different places, you know, for example, there are many people that hold that they like Tinoch Shenishba. Others believe that there's a problem because we recognize the Kedushin, but many do not recognize the Gittin, and therefore there's an Indian of Safek Mamzerut. So, I'm not getting into it. This is a rabbinical thing, which is
right.
Way out of my expertise. So, I'm in no position to say anything about it. I'm just looking at what others say.
Obviously, in order to understand a sefer, its value, you obviously have to know the history of the sefer, its place within the time when it was published and so on, which means that you obviously have to have a very, very good knowledge of our history as a nation. Since most people today do not know very much about the difference between the Karaim and Rabbinical Judaism, care to explain it in a few words, in a few sentences, what exactly is the main difference? Other than the fact that supposedly they do not believe in Torah Shebal Peh, and yet they have their own Perushim. How is it possible if you don't believe in any of the commentaries, how can you have your own Perushim?
Okay, the Karaite explanation is that they believe in a very strict interpretation of Torah. For example, they say, Lo tvaru esh b'chol moshot techem b'yom ha-shabbat. That means you cannot have fire even if you put it on mibad yom, erev Shabbat. So, they cannot have what we have, chulled, because it's cooking on Shabbat. However, what they do is they cook the food today and they put it in a thermos bottle, and that's how they keep it warm for Shabbat. But they will not have lights, they will not have Nerot Shabbat, because that's against their interpretation of Lotvaru Esh. Then the early Karaites had a big machloket about Al Teitzu Mimkotechem B'yom HaShabbat. Now, Eliyahu Bashatin, who lived in Constantinople in the 15th century, tried to follow more the rabbinic interpretation, and many of the Karaites followed him. Some didn't. So it's a very complicated thing, because according to Karaite theology, everybody's supposed to interpret Torah his way. And strangely enough, any novice could say, this is my interpretation, and I don't care what, for example, Anan said, who was supposedly one of the first Karaim. Now, whether he was the first or he couldn't put together a group of such people, we don't know. It's a big argument. But anyhow, Rav Sadia Gaon was the one that had the biggest machlokets with them, and this thing is continuing today. In Israel today, there are between 20 and 30,000 Karaim. There's still some Karaim in Eastern Europe and in Constantinople. But with the advent of, say, the 19th century, when actually towards the end of the 18th century, when they started in Russia taking Jewish kids for 20-year military service, and they doubled the taxes on the Jews, so the Karaites came up with a brilliant idea to say that they're not Jews, and they left Palestine before the crucifixion, and therefore they were not part of those. They didn't take part in the crucifixion, and therefore they should not be treated as Jews. Amazingly, the Tsarina bought it. They accepted it, and they excluded the Karaites from double taxation and from taking the kids into military service. In fact, they put out a book praising the Tsar for this. I have a copy of that book. It's a rare book. It was printed in Hebrew and translated into Judeo-Tatar by Firkovich. And this thing went on. So today, some of the Karaim in Crimea and in Poland, where they still have a couple of hundred, and in Lithuania, where they still have a couple of dozen old Karaites, they believed that they are not Jews, they are the descendants of the Khazars. So that's where it's at. In Egypt, there's a big Karaite community, which almost all ended up in Cairo, which almost all of it ended up in Israel, and a minority of about 1,000 to 1,000 ended up in Dallas City, California, which is outside of San Francisco, and they believe that they're Jews. They all believe that they call themselves Hayudim HaKaraim. Now, when it goes to Talmud, they accept a great part of it. They just don't accept all of it. They pick and choose what they accept. They say the Talmud has a lot of good things in it and has things that they don't like. So it's not that they reject it completely. For example, Haftarah is clearly, it's a Talmudic thing. It's not from the Tanakh. And the first book that was printed in their press in Chufut Kaleh was the Haftarot. So the Karaite Haftarot are very similar to our Haftarot. I'm writing an article on this because in 1520 or so, they put out a Chumash with two sets of Haftarot. So some people said that this was one for the Karaim in Kushtar, and the other was for the Rabbanites in Kushtar. And I've proved that no, that's wrong. It is not the Karaite Haftarot.
Now, I understand that the Haftarot were chosen because at one point it was prohibited for the Jews to read from the Torah, so they would take passages from the Tanakh that were somewhat similar, that spoke of similar incidents. And as a rule, both Ashkenazim and Sephardim have very, very similar Haftarot with some small differences, a few extra psukim here, a few fewer psukim, whatever. What are there any serious differences, any serious discrepancies between our Haftarot and the Haftarot of the Karaim?
The Haftarot of the Karaim are very similar to the Haftarot of the Byzantine Jews. The Jews that were in Constantinople before Golay Sfarad came there. So they probably adopted it from the Byzantine Jews.
Now, why would they have adapted the Haftarot? I mean, it was definitely, you know, as you said, the Talmudic. Why would they adapt it if officially they do not accept Torah Shebal Peh?
You see, there's a huge problem with Karaite history. Number one, they wrote very little about their history. So we know very little. All the people that did real research are non-Karaim. And they did not... They didn't even go into printing. There are very few Karaite books that were printed. For example, in the 16th century, there are only four Karaite books that were printed. In the 16th century, there are only four Karaite books. There is nothing in the 15th century. The first Karaite book was printed in 1528, incredibly, by Bamberg, and it's the Karaite Machzor, which is the prayers for the whole year, which is a big book.
Does it differ from our...
Oh, yes. I have a copy. I have an almost complete copy of that book. It's a very rare book. It's very different. For example, there's no Shmona Esrei, because it's Talmudic. So there are, most of the Tefillot of the Karaim come from Tehillim, Paitanim, the Karaite Paitanim. Interestingly enough, they also have quite a few Piyutim by Yehuda Halevi in the Karaite Siddur.
He definitely was no Karaite.
No, but they like it.
Yeah. Any other interesting, fascinating things you care to talk about in the last few minutes we have? Like, for example, any interesting stories besides that one that you told before?
Coming across Hebrew books and find ownership signatures of Gedolei Yisrael makes it a book very fascinating. For example, you leaf through a book and you find a signature or Haga'ot from the Chassam Sofer or Rebbe Kiva Eger. Clearly, if you would come across the Ktav of the Rambam, it would be the most fascinating. We do know that we do have quite a few letters and manuscripts from the Rambam. Unfortunately, I don't think we have anything from Rashi, but even of later Gedolim, say from the 16th, 17th, and 18th century, it's a big find whenever you find one. And I always look for them, you know, I look for names, ownership signatures. And I did come across several ownership signatures. For example, I had a couple of Sfarim that belonged to the Chida, where he signs his name. It's interesting, he has a couple of different signatures, and it's not always easy to read it because he writes it in Sephardic way. But after a while, you get used to it, and you're able to read it. Yes. So when I'm looking for books, I'm looking for things like that as well. So it could be a minor book, but if it belonged to the Chida with his signature on it...
So it makes it major.
Makes it major.
How does one get in touch with you?
I have a email, which is HebrewBook@hotmail.com. HebrewBook, one word, @hotmail.com. You can ask me questions, advice. What I do, I set up, I assist people creating libraries. I advise people. I buy for people at auctions all over the world. I've set up quite a few libraries, and I advise quite a few people. One of the people that used to be my customer was the late Ludwig Jesselson, whom I bought many books. I bid for people at auctions. I check the books out to make sure that they complete and it's what they think it is. And basically, the way to get in touch with me is at HebrewBook@hotmail.com.
Okay, thank you very, very much, Mr. Eidlis. It was a pleasure speaking to you. I enjoyed this very much. There is a lot that I would like to hear, but fortunately we're out of time. We're going to have you on our show again, Bezrat Hashem.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity, and I would love to talk about more specific things in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, and good night, ladies and gentlemen. Tune us in next week, next Wednesday, at 8 o'clock for our next exciting show. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. You can see our blog at koshersin.wordpress.com. Thank you, and good night, one and all.